This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcast. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. We got some global trade for you on the program today. There's a guy in Silicon Valley who's got a new job. We'll tell you about him. And also, it turns out, we can tell you how much that operation you need is going to cost you. Seriously. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the 5th of October. Great as always to have you with us, everybody. The big news of the day, and when I say big, I mean, about 40% of all global trade. It came bright and early this morning from Atlanta, Georgia. Negotiators there working on the Trans-Pacific Partnership wrapped up more than 5 years of talks just as the sun was coming up. There was a battle down to the wire over sugar and dairy, cars as well, all the usual stuff you find in a big trade deal. The TPP covers services as well, though, and e-commerce, data transfers, and this is important, a relatively new class of medicines. They're called biologics, and it was the debate over them that almost derailed the whole thing. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains what biologics are and why they were such a sticking point.
Combine an emotional issue, like access to medicine, with a powerful industry like pharmaceuticals, and you've got trade talk drama. Judith Rios with Doctors Without Borders says even defining biologics is tricky.
It really covers many of the new medical tools, medical products, including not only drugs, but also vaccines.
The issue for TPP negotiators was actually an intellectual property one. It's a little wonky. How long should drug makers get the exclusive rights to the clinical data needed to get their drugs approved before makers of generics can follow suit? Current U.S. law is 12 years, but some TPP countries have 0 years of protections, others 5 or 8. Doctors Without Borders is worried about the cost of drugs in the developing world and wanted the TPP to knock all its countries down to zero.
1 more year of monopolistic protection will mean 1 less year of access to generics and competition, therefore higher prices.
But many name-brand pharmaceutical companies wanted the opposite, to bring all TPP countries up to 12 years. Patrick Kilbride with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce points to the cost companies incur to develop these drugs.
So to keep that pipeline of new medicines going, you need that incentive, that period of exclusivity that lets them recoup their investment and then go on to make the next breakthrough.
In the end, TPP negotiators didn't agree on one overarching system. The U.S. can keep its 12 years. Other countries will have at least 5 years, perhaps more. Ishwar Prasad, a trade policy professor at Cornell University, says the compromise shows just how hard this issue was.
Clearly, it was important for them to recognize the political constraints related to this issue within each country, but it was also very important for them to move forward on this deal.
In the end, he says, it's remarkable negotiators finally came to an agreement at all. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Maybe the most pressing question in high tech has finally been answered. All right, maybe not the most pressing, but totally the most gossiped about. Twitter finally has a CEO. Co-founder Jack Dorsey is going to take the job on a permanent basis and keep running his other big company, Square, at the same time. We've got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, on the line with more on this one. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
So you surprised at all?
I am not too surprised, no. I mean, this was definitely reported last week, but it also really just felt like this was the only option. Jack's their guy, and they were going to have him come hell or high water.
Okay, Jack being the man, let me then ask you this. What is it exactly that he now has to sell? What is Twitter's product, I guess?
Right. That is exactly the thing I think Jack Dorsey now has to determine and sell to both advertisers and the market at large. What is Twitter? What does it do? And why is it valuable? There's a lot of value in real time. I think everybody realizes mm-hmm. that. Yep. The original concept of Twitter was that it would bring you immediacy and it would bring you news. And now products like Periscope bring you video in real time. There's really a lot of value in that. What Jack has to do is prove that he can make a lot of money off that.
Okay, so let's talk track record. Not his first time running this company, but the last 3 months of his life as interim CEO. What has he done in the past 90 days to make the board say, oh, you're it?
Yeah, you know, I think the thing that he has done is actually get things done. And that sounds a little recursive, I know. But Twitter had felt a little stagnant to a lot of people. And what he has done is he's actually moved up product launches. Things have happened. He's changed around staffing. He's moved forward on things like Project Lightning, which was their sort of secret news and information curation mm-hmm. service. So he's pitching Twitter as a product that will help you know what's important when news is breaking or put more trustworthy content up front. They've partnered with Stripe. Twitter partnered with Stripe on things like a buy button in tweets, which makes Twitter more useful and which they mm-hmm. could also maybe take a cut of. They could make some money. There are smaller user-friendly things like getting rid of the 140-character limit on direct messages. Just today, actually, they announced that you could use super-sized emoji in direct messages. So I think we can all agree that things are happening. Big things are happening.
It is the apocalypse when the day we have super-sized emoji.
But to be fair, he's getting okay. things done.
All right, fine. But let me ask you this question, right? So my mom, were she online? She's not, but that's a whole different story. My mom could go on Facebook and know what it's for. She can see the kids and she can see her friends and, you know, all that jazz. How are you going to get people to figure out what Twitter is enough so that they're going to want to stick around?
Yeah, that's still a hard sell. And I think that is the central question. You can do all the defining you want. You can have ancillary products like Periscope. But if you can't get people to understand why they should stay on Twitter, then you've got a really tough mm-hmm. road ahead. And maybe it does come down to Twitter changing its algorithm and doing something that's a little more like newsfeed so that no matter who you are, if you go there, you will find news that's important to you or interesting to you. They're talking about how people who are not logged into Twitter are spending more time there. So even if it doesn't become a communications platform yeah. where people build up a lot of followers or talk to their followers, the goal for Twitter has to be interesting and make people want to come back over and over.
If I had a supersized Molly Wood emoji, I'd throw it out right here. Molly Wood, she is our senior tech correspondent. Thank you, Molly.
Smiley face, Kai.
Twitter shares today up about 7% or so, but don't believe anybody you read on Twitter who tells you they know what's going on Wall Street lately because they're lying to you. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. American Apparel filed for bankruptcy today. The clothing retailer, with Made in America being its claim to fame, has struggled with infamy lately. A CEO accused of sexual misconduct who was fired and is now suing. And there is, of course, a little matter of profits. The company hasn't had any in 6 years. Easy though it is, it's not fair to pick on American Apparel. A host of once big-name clothing brands has struggled of late. Abercrombie, Gap, J. Crew, and others have all cut staff or closed stores this year. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has more on what gives.
The American Apparels, Gaps, and Abercrombies of the world made their names by selling their logos, often right on the clothes. But industry consultant Wendy Liebman says today's young shoppers are not impressed. They're heading to stores with high fashion at cheap prices.
Now, the H&Ms, the Zaras, the Uniqlos, fast fashion, off the runways, into the stores. 6 weeks later, a whole new selection.
Did you catch the operative term there? It's fast fashion. Here's retail industry analyst Paula Rosenblum.
Like they say in Project Runway, one day you're in, the next day you're out. There's truth to that.
The challenge, says Rosenblum, is that struggling brands have a talent shortage and can't get back in the in crowd.
What they need is someone with the creative chops to help them get cool again. And it's just finding these guys is a bit like finding a unicorn, you know?
Even if companies find their unicorns, they're trotting on shifting ground. Retail strategist Kevin Kelly says fast fashion may be doing well now, but there are already indications that it too has an expiration date. He's got another operative term, connoisseurship.
Consumers are realizing that it's better to own two really great pair of jeans than 10 pair of really cheap jeans.
Kelly says niche retailers are winning in this environment by telling compelling stories
about how it was made, what processes they went through, and there's a real personal vision.
Kelly says these kinds of successes will grow in coming years, putting more pressure on big-name retailers. I'm Nova Safo for Marketplace.
From the Marketplace desk of, wait, your tickets are how much? This story today, a top-of-the-line pass to Disneyland right here in Southern California, is now going to run you more than 1,000 clams. For that, you can brave the crowds any day you want. No blackouts, no nothing all season long. A single day's admission stays the same, but for the first time, Disney is considering off-peak pricing at its parks, charging more on busy days, less when things are quiet. Marketplace's Adrian Hill is on that one.
Wharton School marketing professor John Zhang took his family to Orlando over Christmas a few years ago.
So what happened is that one of the parks was just so crowded. The Magic Kingdom was so crowded. They closed the door and you can't get a ticket.
He had a disappointed family and a question. Why didn't Disney charge more for tickets at peak times like Christmas and make admission cheaper at slow times, the way movie theaters have discounts for matinees?
It's a little bit actually surprising that Disney has not done this.
Turns out Disneyland Paris is trying it. General admission is $94, but on quieter days, it drops to $64. Tony Christopher is president of Landmark Entertainment Group. He's been in the theme park business for 35 years. He says Disney has a tough balancing act when it comes to ticket pricing.
Ultimately, if you go back to what Walt Disney believed, he believed that, you know, Disneyland pricing, first and foremost, should not exclude anyone from being able to go.
So Disneyland should be for everyone, but not everyone can fit. A 3-hour wait for Space Mountain is bad for visitors and bad for Disney.
Yeah, they can't spend money when they're waiting in line.
Christopher says raising prices alone has done nothing to solve the demand problem. Attendance at the theme parks has been breaking records for the last 3 years. So Disney has started surveying visitors about off-peak pricing, hoping to find a way to keep the magic in the Magic Kingdom. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Europe is getting all the headlines, but the fact is there has been a global refugee problem for a while now. Once they leave their homes and their countries, the United Nations says displaced people often still spend years in refugee camps. And then when they are finally settled, they face unique challenges. Some haven't ever worked. They have little or no education. And that's exactly the situation for a group of refugees from the South Asian country of Bhutan. After decades in camps in Nepal, tens of thousands of them have made new homes in Ohio. Lewis Wallace from WYSO took a look at how they're doing.
When Tara Dungana was about to start sixth grade in Bhutan, his family took what he thought was a trip.
When we left the country, my parents were saying, like, we'd come back a few weeks after.
They packed a few bags and left their animals in the yard, vegetables still growing in the garden. They got to Nepal, to a refugee camp, and
I was there in the camp almost 18 years.
He never went home. In the late 80s and early 90s, Bhutan drove out more than 100,000 Lhotshampas, Dungana's ethnic group. The years went by in the camps.
You don't know what tomorrow has for you. It's always dark, right? Tomorrow is always dark.
But more recently, some 66,000 Bhutanese have resettled in the U.S. Dungana came 5 years ago, and at first it was really hard settling in. He found a job quickly but felt really isolated, and when he and his wife came home each day, he says,
we just cried, literally cried.
Now he works full-time helping other refugees find jobs in Columbus.
I think the city is welcoming.
Lots of people come straight from camps where they had nothing to do and no education. In Ohio, they usually find work for low wages in warehouses or hotels. A few Ohio employers have whole teams of Bhutanese workers, with managers speaking in Nepali. Megan Zarnitz is with Catholic Charities in Cincinnati.
We have a large group of individuals who are employed at about the three-month mark, which is what the government aims for.
The federal goal is economic self-sufficiency in 30 to 90 days. After 20 years in a camp, especially for older people, the shock and pressure can lead to depression, and suicide rates are high in the Bhutanese community. You can get a sense of just how big this community is in Columbus at the South Asian Bazaar. It's a nondescript storefront in a small strip mall. Inside, it's hopping. Bimba Stola is a co-owner.
Business is picking up for the community. Like, there's lots of competition. We love competition.
People look at clothes, weigh bags of food. Groups of women come in from a Hindu religious festival, dressed in bright red.
These are ethnically Nepalese garments. And our ladies are really fond of garments.
Bastola spent a little time in the camps, and he's doing great here. But he and his business partner are both educated. Bastola does people's taxes, and his partner runs a realty company out of the back. Bastola says education is the key for those coming out of camps.
Technical education, higher education is a must.
He says the transition has gotten easier as more people have come. But for him, there are still those earlier memories of his life on a farm in the foothills in Bhutan.
I still reminisce those days. Cool air, open air.
He'd like to move out to the Ohio countryside one day.
Away from the din of the city, peaceful, and that's it. That's better quality of life in there.
But he has family here and a shop to run. In Columbus, I'm Lewis Wallace for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Okay, you know there had to be lasers somewhere in the story, so cue the sound effects.
No, come on. Who says business news is boring, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's up 304 points today, 1.8%, closed at 16,776. The NASDAQ up 73 points, 1.5%, 4781. The S&P 500 up 35 points, 1.8%, 19.87 there. The investor Nelson Peltz disclosed he's built a $2.5 billion stake in General Electric and that he's got a plan. Raise GE's share price by borrowing $20 billion and buying shares of GE. GE up 5.3% today. Valeant Pharmaceuticals, the serial acquirer of drug companies, doubled and tripled prices on some old medicines it bought and drew some attention to itself. Valiant down 11% today. Bonds down. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.05%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I saw an article in the New York Times the other day that piqued my interest. A hospital in Utah where they'd figured out exactly what any given medical procedure costs. You think back to the debate over the Affordable Care Act and all that talk about bending the cost curve. You remember that? Well, if you think of that, then you'll understand why this matters. Dr. Vivian Lee is the CEO of the University of Utah Healthcare, the woman who is trying to get to the bottom of just how expensive healthcare really is. Dr. Lee, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
I have to tell you, when I had my second child, I guess, we tried to do a story on how much it costs to have a baby. And pretty much everybody we talked to said, forget it, you're never going to figure it out. How are you doing what you're doing?
That's exactly the same feeling I had when I first started asking that question. And it was about 3 or 4 years ago. I was relatively new to this position here in Utah. And I was being asked to think about healthcare reform, healthcare transformation, payment reform. And I said, well, do we actually know our costs? And people looked at me a little bit askance and said, really? You really want to know all the costs? And I said, yeah. And then our team rolled up their sleeves and they said, okay.
So did you have people actually counting Band-Aids and scalpels and in operating rooms with stopwatches? And I mean, that whole deal?
You know, we didn't do so much intense stopwatch work, but we did cost out pretty much everything. So things like Band-Aids, supplies, we more or less know those costs. Pharmacy, we knew those costs. But some of the things we really did need to cost out in some detail, like what does it cost for every minute in the operating room, yeah. every minute in the ER, every minute in the MRI scanner, for example. And yes, we have been able to cost that out now.
How did it go then with doctors over whose shoulders you are, in theory, looking, saying, it's a little expensive, Dr. Jones?
Well, you know, the doctors have been the most receptive and the most curious and the most eager to have access to the data so they can do something about it. So, unfortunately, we've never had the information to be able to be part of that solution. And so, for example, the first set of data that rolled out for us here at the University of Utah was for total joint replacements, total hip replacements, total knee replacements. And our orthopedic surgeons got a hold of the data, and they were fascinated by it. They never knew, for example, that the different hip prostheses cost us about a 3-to-1 ratio from the most expensive to the least expensive. And then when we looked at patient outcomes, lo and behold, the patients had similarly great outcomes regardless of the cost of the prosthesis. So they could figure out how to improve our practice, and only possible because the doctors had access to the data.
Let me back you up to the whole hip replacement thing and the most expensive to least expensive being a 3-to-1 ratio. It reminds me a little bit of the joke we used to make when I was in the military, that our airplanes were built by the lowest winning bid on a military contract. If I'm getting my hip replaced, I don't want the lowest winning bid. I want the best doggone hip socket I can get.
Okay, so that, I'm so glad you made that point, because one of the concerns that I have with all the attention that is being placed on cost is that we're forgetting the most important part of the value equation, which is the quality and the outcomes.
Right.
So what you really want to be talking about in this country in terms of fixing healthcare is really delivering value. Just like in any other business, we need to deliver value in healthcare.
Fair enough. How much of this is being driven by the changes to medical payments that are being mandated and introduced by the Affordable Care Act?
There's no question that we have to think about changes in the way in which our payment structure rewards us. And we feel just as responsible as everyone for the rising healthcare costs. And so we want to be part of that solution. And so in order to manage our business in that new way, we have to know our costs.
Dr. Vivian Lee, she's a radiologist, but more to the point, the CEO of the University of Utah Healthcare. Dr. Lee, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
Nobody likes pollution. Junk and garbage lying around everywhere getting in the way. It's even worse when the junk is moving at 15,000 miles an hour and might crash into you and kill you. Tens of thousands of pieces of orbital debris, space junk in the vernacular, are up there zooming around, threatening the space station and all of the satellites that we all depend on. Space junk has been a problem for a while, yes, but it's getting worse. So scientists are posing some interesting solutions, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports.
This is a story of 2075, a time in which this space debris has become a major problem.
In the Japanese anime Planetes, teams of low-paid astronauts work to clean up space debris moving at thousands of miles per hour. Today, there actually is something of a threat to the International Space Station and satellites. Raymond Sedwick is an aerospace engineer at the University of Maryland.
Something even the size of a marble traveling that fast, if were to collide with an operational satellite, would certainly disable it.
It's happened to satellites a couple of times already, and astronauts sometimes have to move the ISS out of the way. Remember the movie Gravity? Yeah, that. Right now, the main strategy for dealing with space junk is avoiding it.
The majority of what is being done falls on trying to see where the objects are, trying to predict where they're going to be in the future.
Usually it's too expensive to move satellites out of the way, so the owners just hope. There are also international standards for limiting the amount of debris left behind in space. That's the prevention side. But what about actually cleaning up all the space junk? Okay, you know there had to be lasers somewhere in the story, so cue the sound effects.
It's not totally obvious, but if you shine a pulse laser on a surface, you can make a flash on it, and that flash is a jet.
No, that was totally obvious. Claude Phipps is the founder of Photonic Associates in Santa Fe, New Mexico. What he's saying is that if you shoot a special UV laser at a piece of debris enough times, it will slow it down.
In the case of debris, you only have to slow it down just a percent or so of its own velocity before it'll re-enter and burn up in the atmosphere.
He says that will work for smaller pieces. Bigger chunks and old satellites might need to be hauled to a spot where they can fall into the atmosphere and burn up. But who's going to pay for it?
Governments are internationally responsible for their space activities, and they're potentially liable for any damage that their national space activities cause.
Chris Johnson is a space lawyer, yes, that's a real job, for the Secure World Foundation. He gives the example of China. It decided in 2007 to show off its anti-satellite missile by blowing up one of its satellites, creating thousands of pieces of debris. Johnson says countries and companies may start to get more interested in cleanup.
If you look at what space debris actually is, and you see that it's high-grade, refined metals that we've already launched and put into space, that's a resource that entrepreneurs might look at as a resource they can draw from.
But right now, cleanup isn't really a top priority for companies and governments going into space. Here's Claude Phipps again.
The bottom line is, so far, the cost of tolerating the debris is less than the cost of dealing with it.
Until a major communication or military satellite ends up out of commission because of a stray screw. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which the phrase, there's an app for that, finally means something tangible. A new startup called AirPaper wants to spare its customers the pain and heartache of layers of bureaucracy and wasted time. It will file the paperwork and make whatever required phone calls are necessary for follow-up to take care of whatever it is that you need. Their first service will be canceling Comcast subscriptions. You give them $5, you fill out a form, they do the rest. Totally worth it. All right, we got to go. Is the happy music all over the place today? The Dow up 304 points, almost 2%, 1.8% there. The NASDAQ gained 73 points, about 1.5%. The S&P 500 up 35 points, 1.8% there as well. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.